Right across the UK and around the world on the internet, by webcast and podcast, my name is Howard Hughes and this is The Unexplained. It's very good to be back. And as usual, there's a story about why I was away, and I can explain it very quickly. For everybody who emailed, here's the reason, and thank you very much for bearing with me and sticking with this program and this concept. Basically, I work for a radio station Monday to Friday, and I've got a morning drive time news job. So I'm the news guy in London on this radio station, which is very good, called 102.2 Smooth Radio. If you're passing through London, or you can access it on the internet or get it on the digital television in the UK. And that's taken up an awful lot of my time because the station's been through some changes lately, so we've been making some alterations there, and that's basically eaten up an awful lot of the time that I would have spent on this. But this is back, and for all the people, and there are a lot of you, so I won't mention you individually, but for all the people who emailed during this period that this has been away, thank you very much. Thank you for keeping the faith. Thank you for the ideas and suggestions and comments, and for basically keeping me going when I thought, well, I wonder if we can keep up with this. But I believe in this concept. I believe in this show, and believe me, my aim is to get it back on the radio where it belongs. And it's not just me saying that it belongs on the radio, it's you saying it too. It's not a campaign, it's not a crusade, it's just something that I think ought to be done in the UK. It's done in other parts of the world, it's done in the United States very successfully. So why the hell can't we do it here is what I say. And that's what I want to do. And thank you very, very much for all the emails. On this show, we've got Major Ed Dames. He is the king of remote viewing. They call him Dr. Doom in America because he sees things which are not always very nice, but he thinks they have to be said. So Ed's first up. Long interview. Also, I've got Tony Buzan, very well known on the television in the UK, a bit of an expert on the brain and improving your mental powers. I think, in a way, we talk on The Unexplained always about things that we think are external to us, like beings of light and UFOs and God and all sorts of things which are concepts and out there and we can debate all day and all night. But perhaps the biggest mystery of them all is the one inside our skulls, our brain. How is it that a piece of mush like that does the things that it does, apparently, if that's where all of the things that we are and all of the things that we do come from? How is it all possible? So Tony Buzan and I have talked about that. We'll have him on second up. And third up, it will be a great pleasure to welcome somebody who is very, very well known in the United Kingdom and around the world as being the godfather of the television astronomers. This man is a wonderful man who I first met in 1994, around the time of the movie's release, Apollo 13, which was a great movie. And Patrick Moore, astronomer, television astronomer, covered the real Apollo 13 on television in the UK, and that whole drama about whether those astronauts who were in trouble in space would actually get back to Earth alive or not. Patrick was there, so he was very interested in the movie. And I talked to him then, came to like him, and have talked to him off and on over the years. Well, his television program, which introduced astronomy and the stars to people like me as a little boy, called The Sky at Night, is celebrating 50 years. So it will be a great pleasure from his home in Sussex near Chichester to have Patrick Moore, astronomer and very, very interesting man, a man who's actually met Einstein, on this show as our last guest. But first up, let's talk to Major Ed Dames in the United States. He was originally living in Maui, Hawaii. He will be shortly going to one of the constituent parts of what used to be the Soviet Union. Remote viewer, you know about remote viewing. We talked about it on The Unexplained many, many times. The ability to use and train your mind to see things which are external to you, things which people are seeing or doing through the collective unconscious. Ed Dames explains this better than I ever will, and always does. So, Major Ed Dames in the United States, remote viewer extraordinaire, it's a great pleasure to have you on The Unexplained, my friend.
The pleasure is mine, Howard. It's good to be here again.
But, you know, I can't believe, Ed, that the last time you and I talked, and we've talked a few times on various radio stations in various places, but the last time you and I talked was about 18 months ago. You know that? A long time.
That is a long time. In fact, my Alzheimer's makes it feel like it's just yesterday.
Well, yeah, that's the way that works, isn't it? I don't know. Where are we going to start this? I tell you, I think we need to go back to where we were in the last few minutes of when we talked last. Now, there's no reason in the world why you ought to remember, you know, what we talked about. But I'll tell you, you told me that you were imminently about to make contact with aliens, as they call them, on a mountaintop somewhere I can't remember. And I don't remember hearing subsequently anything about that. Fill me in. What happened?
Actually, it was not and is not a mountaintop. It's actually a very wide, open area. in the American Southwest. And I did not use the term aliens. In fact, we do not know. I used the term a higher intelligence or an intelligent agency. A higher intelligence. And I call it an agency for lack of a better word. We do not know what this agency is comprised of, whether it is extraterrestrial, interdimensional, or whatever. But what my team was searching for was the agency behind that event in Harare, Zimbabwe in 1994, the one I talked about at the Ariel School, where many school children went out into the bush to meet these ostensibly, because ostensibly it could be an illusion, a projection, meet bug-eyed humanoids and a flying saucer. Now, what we were interested in is what was the agency behind that? And then when we discovered it was a real enigmatic event with a higher intelligence behind it, my intent then became to contact them. And that took us to investigating the protocols for contact, which appeared to be just go to a particular place, they will know you're there, and stand and wait. So all of our work in remote viewing centered around locating this particular place in the world, and it turned out to be, actually there were two places, one in the southern hemisphere, one in the northern hemisphere. The northern hemisphere location is in the American Southwest, and we've actually put off our expedition until July of this year.
And that's going to be a Northern Hemisphere expedition, not a Southern Hemisphere expedition, right?
Correct. And logistically speaking, it's just far easier because we live here in the U.S.
Okay, I'm asking you this for a reason, because I have a lot of contacts in South Africa, and in fact, people listening to this in South Africa, and they are telling me that there is growing awareness of all of these things down there, possibly more so than here in England.
Well, there's less skepticism, and I'm not saying the skepticism is not healthy. It is, and I don't ask, for instance, many scientists to swallow remote viewing as soon as I put the spoon in front of their face. I want them to be skeptic. You know, someone in my position does not want to attract sheep, just believers without proof. We want to be able to demonstrate that what we do, remote viewing, is true. But on the other hand, you don't have minds that have closed or have been compartmented by materialism and the media and belief systems. We have so many solid belief systems and rock-solid paradigms in the modern world that in the lesser developed countries, these things become walls and prisons.
What you taught me about remote viewing over the years is that you have to have a target, and you have to have a questing mind to have a target. So it's good that people ask questions, and it's good that people are skeptical, I would imagine, yeah?
Yeah, again, you don't want sheep. But at the same time, tangentially, you really cannot convince people of the power of remote viewing until you train them and they do it for themselves. That's the only way I have found in my 25-year career in this field to really convince people that it's real. They have to be able to do it themselves.
Tell me briefly, and it's always hard to do this, isn't it? Whenever I've asked you, okay, for people who've never heard of this before, or for people who've only heard the phrase, describe what it is and what it does. But I wonder if you've got a potted way. You know, you meet somebody in a bar and they say, okay, I've heard you're a remote viewer. What's that? What do you tell them?
Well, I generally carry around with me on airplanes. I travel over the world constantly. In my travels, I take things like the U.S. News and World Report special edition on spying, and in that is a good article on psychic spying and how we used it. I just shove that under their noses as they read this, and that's a good synopsis. But in a venue such as this, what I say is that everything in the universe, this is our working hypothesis and appears to be a good one, especially for those of us on the streets who use this day to day. Everything and every idea in the universe exists as a pattern of information. Think of a global mind, a universal mind. We do not have individual minds. We have individual consciousnesses as a result of having a brain which acts as an oscillator, an electronic oscillator, which it does. We can tune that oscillator to any of these patterns. Any pattern exists, sort of like a radio frequency. a radio station. The patterns are ideas. They exist as idea patterns. It could be you. It could be the microphone that you're using. It could be the ideas, abstract ideas such as love or hate. All these things exist as a pattern. There are no words in the global mind, just patterns. We tune our mind to it. We inject a word idea. Let's say Osama bin Laden's present location. Okay, that directs consciousness to tell our unconscious mind, which is hooked into this global mind, where to go, what to focus on, where to tune. And then our unconscious awareness becomes focused on that particular frequency. And it stays there because of the protocols that have been discovered in remote viewing that allow us to maintain contact with that certain radio station, allegorically speaking, for 45 minutes or more and not lose the target.
So quite often, all of us, and I've done this, you can have an idea of what somebody might be thinking or doing or saying connected with you, but actually being able to discern very clearly what that is and what's going on is, for most of us, very, very difficult, if not impossible. It's like trying to sort out a single grain of sand on a beach. You're saying what you do is you sort that tiny little item out from the great mass of white noise around it.
Without any problem. We've learned how to take any specific idea pattern, anything, any person, place, or thing, or an event, lock onto it, and download as much information as we want for as long as we want, and that's using the protocols that we've established. It's a lot of work, but it's worth it, of course, especially if you pick and choose your targets. Correctly. For instance, right now, one of the targets that my team and I are working this particular week is we're locating a strong box from a stagecoach robbery in the Old West that hasn't been discovered. And that kind of money funds our other humanitarian and social support projects.
How do you even start to do that? Do you have to look at a similar strong box, get it in your mind, this is the thing that I'm looking for, and then you know the location where it was jettison, missing, whatever.
There's two ways for us to decide on which mind target we pick. One, we could read about or be informed about a particular target. In this case, let's say a particular stagecoach robbery by Black Bart, where he stole a strong box. The strong box wasn't recovered. We can turn our attention using very, very precise protocols. In fact, if anyone is interested in learning more about this, they can go to my website. We'll talk about that later, and they can get all the information they need on remote viewing.
So are you getting into the mind of Black Bart?
Negative. Oh. We're not interested in the mind of Black Bart. We want the money. We want the gold. Who cares about Black Bart? He's dead and gone. You know, we're alive in this particular era.
And as they say, is your confidence high that you're going to find it and the money?
Oh, yes. The gold in the box. We've already sketched the target. It's one of the things we do in our work is sketch and draw the particular target so we know exactly what we're going after. And then we locate it. There is another way of finding treasure or meteorites or gold veins or anything that we're interested in, and that is something that we call a topical search, where we could take a point, let's say Johannesburg, South Africa, and then turn our attention to the nearest accessible, available undiscovered oil deposit or something like that. That's another way we can do it. It's a lengthy process, but it's doable. And then the hardest work, those things, to describe a target take only a couple of hours, but to locate it can take a couple of weeks. That's a very, very detailed process. But it's worth it in some cases.
So this is a hell of a spread of work, from locating physical items and objects and, you know, finding the money, show me the money, as they say, to making a connection in July, you say, with some kind of external intelligence that might blow all of our minds.
That's the capstone of my personal career, and that's something I have a philosophy about why that is so important. I think that that agency will, as I've mentioned many times, unfortunately, we're going down. The human race is is going down fast. I'm not saying extinction. I'm just saying, you know, we're in the next 50 years approaching a Mad Max scenario for all the reasons that you and I know.
Well, it seems to be something that I know Art Bell, American radio host, talked about. There was a book that he put together called The Quickening. Everything seems to be getting faster and faster and faster in this world. Things are happening all together. We've got global warming. We've got political instability. I mean, hell, recently we even had an earthquake in an area 60 miles out of London, which doesn't get earthquakes.
Yeah, I've been shot as a messenger. I've been shot and shot at many times. The bottom line is, I truly believe that that when we rebuild, when humans rebuild, when we reestablish our culture as humans, if we don't have mentorship and help, we're going to repeat the same mistakes because we are flawed. I don't care how spiritual one is and all of the other good things about us, and there are many, of course, in terms of character and human character, we're going to make the same mistakes again. I believe we need mentorship, and I believe that this agency out there has been overwatching us for a long time. What we need to do is ask them, or perhaps they'll impose themselves on us, but one way or another, we need some help. So my philosophy is to invite them to actually set up a tactical command post now, begin as a vanguard to communicate with the agency that we want as mentors to help us rebuild when we need to. That's the reason I want contact, and the only reason.
So this agency, do you believe this agency is something extraterrestrial, or is it an intelligence of what do they call them, ascended masters, people who have been and achieved before and exist in another dimension? What do you think? What's your best guess?
My best guess, after 25 years of looking at them, the particular agency, is that it's a combination of both. That a very, very advanced races out there in the cosmos become aware at some juncture of entities that exist in another dimension that are always there, but are just beyond, not beyond their ken, but beyond their bandwidth, their operating bandwidth visually and perceptually as humans or whatever one might be out there. And that once those two forces combine, that becomes what has heretofore been called the Federation, a la Star Trek. The Federation consists of, in my mind, both material beings out there and also these other dimensional beings.
And they want to save us. They want to help us anyway.
I don't know what their agenda is, actually. I'm guessing that the agenda, looking ahead, we know that they're here with us when we rebuild. So I'm assuming that their intent, one, at least part of it, is to help us rebuild. That's my best guess.
And the process of this planet coming unstuck, collectively, all of us going completely off the radar and having to, you've talked about us having to live in pods or underground or somewhere well away from everything because of what happens to this planet. That process, you think, is ongoing now?
That process is beginning now and will happen very, very, very rapidly now. In fact, so rapidly I can no longer keep up with the hammer that's going to drop on us. I mean, you could look at minor things, a global economic collapse, which is going to happen. But this confluence of events in terms of disease, solar flares, earthquakes, volcanism, that kind of thing, it's going to whipsaw humans around so much that at this point in time, it doesn't behoove me and my team to really forecast what's up next. Just too many things. What we're looking at is survival and rebuilding, period.
I'm talking to you on a day when the temperature is ridiculously high for the time of year, and we've had a sustained period here in London, where I'm recording this, of very high temperatures that are very pleasant to go and cycle in or go down to the seaside in, but it's just not right.
Are you sure it's just not hot flashes for your
Well, it could be. It could be. It's the stress and the time of life,
right.
I think, Ed. You know, I knew it would get me in the end. I think it probably has now. But, you know, seriously, people say, oh, isn't it nice, but isn't it unusual? But do you think it's part of a pattern of something?
Yes, I do. And I think it's a natural pattern. I honestly do, Howard, that I believe these changes, we just happen to be alive in a very interesting time geophysically. I believe that these changes, these weather changes, for what we have seen happen so at the geophysical level, where we normally think of eons of time, millions and millions of years, that that is not necessarily the case, that these weather changes, geophysical changes, happen in the blink of a geophysical eye. In fact, I take exception to the global warming theorist. Yes, humans are contributing to some of their demise in terms of the weather, in terms of the climate, but not to the... Take a look at Mars right now. Take a look at Mars. Mars's southern ice pole appears to be melting. Now, has global warming on Earth contributed to that? Uh-uh. It's the sun. El Sol, our star, is producing the effects that we're feeling on this planet.
And you've been saying this for a long time. You've talked about a thing from the sun called the kill shot, this great flare, solar flare, that will, you know, help to see us on our way. But I have to say, there is at least one weather forecaster who I know here in London who is trying to, he's a voice in the wilderness, but he's getting louder, trying to tell everybody all these weather changes that you're talking about. You're talking about global warming and how we're polluting the planet and ruining everything. It's not true. It's all down to the sun. And this guy puts out regular weather bulletins, and he turns out very often, and more so lately, to be right. And his whole premise is based, as yours, on the sun.
Well, for years and years, I've been saying that scientists do not see, much less understand, the linkage between the sun and the Earth's core. There's an extreme constant linkage. As goes El Sol, there goes the planets around it. And we're focusing on the symptoms. We're looking at the effects of what's going on. And we can't, because of our instrumentation and our understanding, I say we, scientific corporately, we do not understand the linkage between our star and our planet.
We've talked about all these things being a confluence, a lot of stuff all happening at the same time. I mean, look, one tiny little element of it is, in the United States, I've been very interested this year to see the property prices in many areas are going down. Now, if that was happening here in the UK, where they are spiraling and they just do not stop whatever happens, but if that was happening here, alarm bells would be ringing like you wouldn't believe it.
Well, they will be soon, because it's no longer an age where you have independent financial systems. Everything's linked to each other. And watch, the economy of the world has been a house of cards for the last decade. And the first card to fall is the housing bubble in the United States. But no nation will escape that, because everything is linked now. So as this house of cards collapses slowly, think of a time-lapse photography, there's the UK as one of the cards, and it just hasn't been able to fall fast enough yet. But watch.
Well, I live in an apartment in London. It's quite a nice area. It's a very humble apartment, but its value, I bought it, when was it, 1994? It's now worth four times what I paid for it.
I'd sell it now and rent somewhere if I were you.
But where should I go? Should I stay in the UK? Should I get out? What should I do, Ed?
No, there's nothing wrong with the UK. I'm just saying, if you would like to save some money, the home value, I mean, if you're living in it and you like it and you want to stay there, that's fine. But if there's someplace else you think about moving, make sure you get rid of that apartment.
So in other words,
now,
if I want to go, then and this goes for an awful lot of us, it's maybe time to think about going and renting.
No, Howard, it's not time to think about it. It's time to do it. The time to think about things is over. We don't have the luxury of having that time buffer any longer.
When you look ahead to countries like the US and the UK and what politicians do about these situations, then what do you see? Do you see organization or do you see turmoil?
I see complete turmoil. In terms of this entity we call the Antichrist, I see that as actually arising in the UK, believe it or not. But I don't want to go into that at this juncture.
I know you've talked about that obliquely, certainly on American radio before, the Antichrist, and there is an Antichrist, and you say the Antichrist is around now, and you're saying the Antichrist is in the UK.
We used to think that the Antichrist was an idea, simply a philosophy and an idea, but that turns out to be, it does turn out to be an individual, and we think that the individual will arise in your country, yes.
Well, jokingly, some people say it's Tony Blair. I'm not sure whether you see him.
No, I really don't want to comment on it.
Include you? Is this person going to be instrumental in terrorism, or
no?
Is it way beyond that?
No. No one will recognize the individual until it's too late.
Well, you've said before that we have 50 years before, as we say in the UK, the world goes pear-shaped. So will this person, the Antichrist, be part of the process of our undoing?
Not geophysically, but sociologically, yes.
Sounds bad, Ed, and yet there is so much...
It's scary, Howard, it's scary.
Well, in this world, you know, there are a lot of bad people in this world. There are a lot of bad things that happen, and I sometimes, you know, when I report the news here in London, wonder why these things happen. But nevertheless, there are a lot of people who are well-intentioned and who think good thoughts. Do you give any credence to the power of collective thought to change reality? In other words, a lot of people thinking good stuff can make good stuff happen.
No, absolutely. I'd be the first one to admit the power of prayer, and not just good thoughts, but the power of petition and prayer. But that is more complex. That's both simple and complex at the same time. In order to understand what the dynamics and the mechanics of prayer, it behooves one to understand the system behind it in order to make it work for you. Those are rather complex issues.
And have you studied, as a remote viewer, the power of prayer, the power of intention?
No, I haven't studied it. I've practiced it. Once I became aware of it, I employ it in my own life.
Is this anything to do with... I know it's nothing to do with the work that you do, but there's a very popular book and DVD that everybody seems to have, and audiobook as well, called The Secret. And that's all about the law of attraction, and you boil it all down, this long DVD and this big book, down to the fact that if you put it out there... the things that you want and the fate that you want to leave, it's going to come back to you.
Well, The Secret is no more than a revisit of the book that's now probably five decades old, As You Think. It's been edited, and it's simply that your thoughts, if they're congruent with your heart, really do affect your life. And that's the long and short of it. The Secret is just a New Age version of that, which is something that's been known by enlightened people for ages and ages. Nothing new there.
I always really enjoy talking to you. I find it really hard because you talk in a very multifaceted way. There are so many things that we could get into. And the fact of the matter is, what you're saying, it boils down to 50 years from now, we're in trouble and there's nothing we can do.
No, it doesn't boil down to that, Howard. It boils down to right now we're in trouble. And there are a few things that we can do personally, but not corporately, because our corporate destiny, global destiny, is locked. It's locked in. But personally, you know, it's time to really, really think about one's life and how one wishes to survive and forage and interface with other survivors, those kinds of things.
But I'm talking to you from London, and if you watch people, 9 million people live in this city. It's a lot like New York these days. They commute into work, they're on the public transport, they're in their cars, they're living their lives, and they have decreasingly less time, if that's a good way to put it, to think about anything other than just making a living and keeping going.
Well, when the power grids go down next year or year and so on, there's no electrical power because of solar flares and protons coming down to the deck and all that, they'll have a little bit of time to sit back. Hopefully it won't be in the summer with no air conditioning, but they'll have time. They'll have time.
Well, I think we're going to have cause to think in the summertime here in the UK, because we had spring temperatures in the 20s Celsius, which is like in the mid-70s Fahrenheit. And there are people who are saying in the papers quite reliably that we're going to be up to 40 degrees Celsius, that's into the hundreds Fahrenheit, this summer. And they're wondering how we, as a people, in a country that isn't built for temperatures like that, is going to cope. How we're going to cope.
Well, as I said 10 years ago, be prepared for the end of seasons. There will be, in the near future, which was 10 years ago, there will no longer be seasons at all. The weather will be chaos, and most importantly, vis-a-vis that particular fact, is that humans will not be able to grow food crops the way they used to grow them. They will have to be grown in a stable environment, and that means putting them either underground or in controlled domes, environmentally controlled domes, in order for food to be able to be grown.
But in the short term, people are saying here in the UK, oh, this is good news because it means we can grow all these tropical fruit varieties, and we can have wine, we can make wine, we already do, but I mean on a much bigger scale here in the UK. So they're saying the temperature's going up and the weather changing is actually good news.
But the vicissitudes of the weather will preclude being able to do that. That is why we have to have, individuals need to have food that's in an environmentally controlled chamber of some type, whether it's at home or at the community level. Just watch what happens, because you cannot grow food out in the outdoors any longer. It's just too dangerous. You'll lose your food.
In what way? Why is it dangerous?
Because the next day you could have a tornado that comes ripping right through downtown London, or you could have a freeze. Right in the summer, you could go from 20 degrees back down to zero. That's how rapid these weather changes will be.
Well, I'd have been very skeptical about what you're saying had we not had a twister in downtown London, as you call it, at the end of last year that ripped a couple of houses to pieces.
Well, get used to those kinds of things, and don't be surprised if all of a sudden you get snow in what is supposed to be early summer or midsummer. Watch.
And this is all down to the activities of the sun.
Correct.
And there is nothing we can do about that.
Correct.
Do you think scientists are working on it?
No. We're in an age of specialists, and there are very few people like the reporter that you've talked about, who is saying, "I'm telling you, blokes, that's a bloody dangerous sun out there." There are very few people who see the forest for the trees. Each specialist has their particular tree, and there are no generalists any longer that are aware or focused on the big picture, because you can't make money doing that as a scientist. You must be a specialist and keep up with your own particular discipline. So folks aren't seeing the big picture.
More and more people are coming to at least question these things, and that has to be good, I'm sure you'd say. You said that we can make preparations now. We can start to think about the nature of our lives. But, you know, what's good advice?
Stop thinking about the nature of your life. You don't have time. You know, you'll be able to do that when you sit out storms. Right now, for instance, think about growing food inside your home or where you have you're growing them in pots and or in terraria, those kinds of things. That's one thing you can think
about. So I've got to get my head around this. You're talking literally in the short to medium term. This is now.
Howard, a city like yours has 3 days food supply on the shelves. If the satellites go down because of single event latch up, because of a solar flare or something like that, there's no communications between the storage units and the trucks and the trains, and there's no there's no radio communication. So you're not going to have food. Food will run out in 3 days.
Now, you know, that makes a lot of sense, and it makes a lot of sense for this reason. Our supermarkets, as I'm sure this idea came from the US, because many ideas like that do, but our supermarkets work on the basis of, you know, supply when you need. In other words, they only have in stock in the individual branches of the supermarket what they need for that day.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to go for next day's food to a depot somewhere and get it. But everything is done on the last minute to save costs and to make it efficient and to keep the food fresh and keep the prices down and all the rest of it.
Yes, an idea adapted from the Japanese, who are very efficient when it comes to supply and demand logistics. Very, very efficient indeed. But the point is that once something happens, no electricity, no communications, no truckage in the cities, you've got to be able to survive. And you cannot, if you're in the countryside, that isn't so much of a problem. One can forage. There's a lot to eat by the oceans and in the country. So that's in fact, only the stupid will die in those environments. But in the city, you must plan ahead. You must otherwise face the consequences.
Some of this stuff is going to be easier for people to take on board in the U.S. because it's a big country where people live in extremes of climate in some cases and extremes of conditions. Here in the U.K., we like to think of ourselves as having a nice, safe country where nothing bad is ever going to happen.
I understand. Yeah, of course, the U.K. is not the only country that has this halcyon rose-colored glass philosophy. You guys are in for a bigger shock than us, I suppose.
I've always thought that it's very important to put people like you on the radio, and I have been wherever I can over these last few years. You know this because I've called you at ridiculous hours of the day to try and get you to do stuff for. But it's really hard because there are not that many places that are putting this information across. I don't know what you think about that, but I personally think it's very important that at least we give people like you a chance to say this, because otherwise, when and if this stuff happens, people are going to say, where did that come from?
I've made I've made many people angry in both the White House. That's where I got my nom de guerre, Dr. Doom, as a major briefing in the White House, saying there's a problem, and people don't like these problems. I've done the same thing corporately, briefing the Ford Aerospace or the General Motors in Dearborn, Michigan, those kind of things, where I say, by the way, here's what your production looks like in the next 10 years. They don't want to hear that. People only want good news.
Well, you know why they don't want to hear it, because if that gets out, what's that going to do to your share, your stock price?
Exactly so. Exactly so. And those on the inside circles, the sanctum sanctorum, those there, they're okay with the message, but they just don't want me to promulgate that to their stockholders, of course.
So in other words, when this happens, if this happens, and you know, I have to still be as much of a journalist to say if this happens, chances are, for a whole variety of reasons and vested interests like politicians and companies who don't want you to know about this, it's going to drop on us out of a clear blue sky.
It won't. You know, it's actually dropping upon us now. Hold that thought for a second, and I want to say that when things start to happen, it's every man for himself. But let's go back to the thought that you're holding. Think about most of Africa today, especially sub-equatorial and sub-Saharan Africa. Life is already absolute hell for people there. I mean, you and I could not imagine a hell worse than many of the people are experiencing today. There can be no hell that's worth it, and I won't go into details because they're too horrifying. So, you know, let's not pretend that there is a bottom line here. There's a point of reference, and look at sub-Saharan Africa today as a point of reference. Hope and pray that life for us in the developed nation, so-called, never gets anywhere near that.
And what will you do if none of this happens? If this, say, 10 years from now, none of this happens, will you sell in May and go away?
Well, that's a problematic thing because, you know, it's a belief system based upon what I perceive as facts. But if it never happens, I will rejoice and live my life. I'm a very happy man. Life is short. I probably got, I mean, on the outside, maybe 30 years at the most, I'd say, of life left. And despite all that's happening around me, I'm going to squeeze out the most happiness and enjoyment I can.
And that's why you're moving to the Ukraine.
Mama didn't raise no fool, and I know, you know, what's coming, and I can prepare as much as I can. I've got some plans. I mean, I like the saying very much. You know, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. I'm aware of that. Things can change.
I like that. I like that a lot. Is part of this process for you then, you moving to Ukraine? I know you're marrying a very nice lady there and you're making a new life in Ukraine very soon. Is this part of the process, or is this just for you?
No, that's just for me. You know, I fell in love, and that's where home is, you know, where the heart is, that kind of thing. And of course, I'll dig in my own way and contribute to the village where I live in there, because I have a lot of knowledge and they don't. And I'll try to make things better for not just myself and my family, but the village that I live in, because it's going to become a required to have some type of mutual support.
It's going to be a hell of a culture shift for you to move from the U.S.
is,
to
yes,
Ukraine.
It is. I'm just learning. I mean, I speak fluent Chinese, but because I lived in China, I never thought I'd have to crash on Russian. But I am.
Okay, well, good luck with your contact event. What else can I call it in July? And we'll have to catch up then. By that time, you'll have moved to Ukraine, won't you?
I move, but I still travel globally. I have to for my work.
Well, we'll have to catch up then. And it's always good to talk to you. There's always a lot to talk about, and a lot of it's not nice, but, you know, it has to be said, I guess.
Again, I want to emphasize to your audience that the only way to really conceive of what I'm talking about and to understand these things, or to look at it yourself rather than hearing just one man speak, and the vehicle by which I have come to this knowledge in the last 25 years is what I teach and practice, and that's remote viewing. if your people want, if your listeners want to know more about
it, give us the website. Yeah,
they can go to the website, learnrv.com.
Learnrv.com.
Correct.
We've promoted that a lot of times, but we'll promote it one more time. Ed, thank you very much indeed again.
Pleasure's mine, Howard.
Good to talk to you.
Pleasure's mine.
There is only one Dr. Doom. His name is Major Ed Dames. Check out his website that he told you about and see what you think. Remote viewing. I think there's an awful lot to it. I haven't actually trained my brain to do it, but I think there are times that all of us perhaps use some of the facets of remote viewing and we don't even know it. This thing we have in our heads, our brain, is an amazing thing. It's a piece of mush. How does it control us in the way that it does? Our complex emotions, our thoughts, our actions, all comes out of there. Isn't it amazing? Isn't it a miracle? And isn't it the biggest mystery of all of them? We might talk about aliens and spacemen and reptilians and all the rest of the panoply of things that we've talked about on The Unexplained, but maybe the biggest mystery and the largest questions of all about what's in our heads, the brain. Tony Bazan, very well known in the UK on television for programs that he's done and training courses that he's done about improving your brain and understanding it. Well, Tony Bazan a few months ago was promoting a device invented by a Japanese professor, I think called Kawashima, called the Brain Trainer, and that gave me an opportunity to talk with him about the miracle that is the human brain.
What has happened is that in the last really 15 years, the human race has discovered more than 95% about the brain than we've ever discovered in the entire history of the race up to today. So it's this last tiny time period where suddenly there's been this burst of information on the brain. We realize that we know about 1% of what there is still to know. But what we do know is pretty profound stuff. We are aware for a fact that the brain is about 100 times more powerful than we had assumed it could be. We do know that it can be trained, which we had thought that it couldn't after a certain age. We do know that it has more intelligences than we thought. We do know that its memory power is absolutely astonishing. And we do know, and this is a nice controversial one, that as you get older, your brain can get better if you train it. And we know this absolutely.
Now, there are mystical aspects to the brain, too. You said that a lot of it is not understood or misunderstood.
Yes.
But there is still the thought that perhaps the brain is something that is inspired from somewhere that isn't within us. And that's always fired by tales that you read on the internet of people who are found dead and subsequently found to have very tiny brains or no brain at all or half a brain or whatever,
yes,
but have still functioned perfectly well.
Yes. I mean, and that actually makes sense in terms of the modern science of the brain. This new little brain training machine by Dr. Kawashima of Japan.
Which we were going to get round to in just a little while, yeah.
Which we will, but what we're actually finding is that with a small section of the brain left, the remaining brain cells, because of their incredible individual power, can take over functions of other parts of the brain that have been damaged or destroyed. So the big key word that is also coming out of brain research is flexibility, that the brain, if it loses one part of itself, will immediately positively invade that damaged area with new brain cells, new connections, and rewire itself.
Well, the brain is an incredibly delicate thing. I know this because, so 6-8 weeks ago, I had an accident and bashed my head quite badly.
Mm.
And quite seriously, the medical people who talked to me said, you actually won't be quite the same after this in small ways for maybe 6 months.
That may be true, but it may not be true, because one of the other things that we found is that the brain is more resilient than we thought. It was thought of it, you know, as a very, as you said, delicate, fragile instrument. But it turns out that it's pretty tough and that it can take the most incredible impacts and have the most astonishing damages and attacks upon it and come back fighting much faster than we'd thought. So when you have a, you know, a severe concussion, which is probably what you had, there is the possibility that you will have no real effects of that other than the memory of the experience within 3 months.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, and I feel as if I'm on track. But at the beginning of this thing, I did find myself And I don't think it was fantasy or mind over matter or anything like that, but I did find myself, for example, slowing down a bit and forgetting things and actually doing my radio job and just not knowing, feeling that I wasn't quite as on the ball as I ought to have been. I now feel 6-8 weeks on, I'm getting back to where I was. But the point that was made to me is that the brain is a very fragile thing that we don't really understand. My doctor called it blancmange in your head.
Oh, what a horrible doubt. Right, change your doctor. What I would say is that the brain is a much tougher thing than we had thought. We thought it was very fragile, which on some levels obviously it is, but it's much more resilient. I mean, I could quote you case after case of people who've had severe strokes and lost half the use of their body. And people said, you know, well, that's it, and, you know, their brain's gone and poor things, and let's look after them. Whereas new doctor's thought on this is, if you have a stroke, we will immediately start to train your brain. We'll get you back into, if you like, mental shape. And there are case after case after case where people who were basically written off.
So a lot of that, Tony, is that you've got to want to do it. If you're in that situation, and my own father was in that situation where he had a stroke.
Yes.
And they said, well, you're going to have some problems here. We're going to have to monitor you. We can't tell you which way this is going to go. But if you really want to get back to where you were, you will. And he did. I mean, he was not the same man for a while. I mean, he still can't write properly with his right hand.
Right.
But curiously, as the last 5-7 years have gone by, he's more able to do even that.
Yes. And you keep telling your dad to keep going, because the more he does that, the more the brain rewires. I mean, one of the most wonderful examples of that is the recently passed away Christopher Reeve, Superman. And he was totally quadriplegic. They said, you'll never move anything again. This is it. You're gone. And he said, I'll walk. And they said, you won't. And he said, I will. And he just focused on it. He studied it. He got every expert in the world to give him information. He scanned all the books, the internet and whatever. And in a swimming pool, 5 years after, he walked. So you tell your dad, you know, anybody who says fragile and, you know, you're going to have problems, don't listen.
So the capacity of the brain is much greater, which brings me obliquely, and we will get round to the subject of this brain training idea in just a second.
Yes,
but it brings me round to another thought, that we often imbue animals with characters and with having thoughts that we didn't think that animals actually were capable of. Does this mean that animals who have smaller brains in general than we do are actually cleverer than we thought, than we believed?
I can't believe you just asked me that question. And the reason why I can't is that as a little boy, my whole life revolved around animals. And I decided a little while ago to write a book on animals and their intelligence. And the conclusion from all my research on every level of animal, you know, from small worms up through insects and birds and fish and mammals, is that they are, as you have just implicated, far more intelligent than we ever thought. They can think, they can count, they can learn, they can feel, they love, they play, they remember, they strategize, they communicate. Much more intelligent, with tiny little brains in comparison to ours. And that's one of the areas where people are saying, well, look, you know, if a bee, a little busy bee, can do all the things it can do with less than 1 million brain cells, and the brain cells of a bee are the same as our brain cells, basic, you know, biocomputer chip is the same. If they can do all that with less than 1 million, what about us with 1 million times more brain cells?
Which leads us neatly into brain training and the whole idea of the brain trainer, doesn't it, really? Because here we have this giant thing sitting on our heads.
Yes.
And potentially we're not using nearly enough of it. And we all these days are required to be better and better and better at what we do.
Yes.
And I think most of us want to be better, faster, more mentally agile and all the rest of it.
Absolutely.
But as time goes by, we're doing too much coffee, we eat the wrong foods, we have stressful lives, and we never quite get round to doing it.
Howard, you sound like me.
But it goes, doesn't it, Tony? It goes for so many of us, living our lives in New York, London, wherever we happen to be.
It certainly does. And what I find encouraging is that the entire world, as I said, I've just come back from Japan. I've just come back also from Mexico, from New York, from Canada, from the Gulf. And around the world, there is this burgeoning, flowering interest in the brain and developing it and solving the problems like stress, like overwork, like forgetting, etc. There is, I think you could say, there's literally a brain revolution going on. And the fact that things like the Brain Trainer are becoming, you know, awarded best gift by groups like Wellbeing. I mean, can you imagine 20 years ago a brain training device being called best gift?
Well, I was very suspicious of it, I have to say, until I took a look at the thing. It reminded me a lot, the concept anyway, of a thing that my father once gave me as a present for a laugh. It was a thing called the Executive Decision Maker, and it was a little box that had flashing lights. One light said yes, one light said no. You asked it a question, hit the button, and it would tell you the answer. Like, should I go out tonight? Ask the Executive Decision Maker. It would flash a little and say yes. So it took all that nastiness away. But this is much more complex than that, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's very simple, and it's also complex. It's based, as I mentioned, on the work of Dr. Kawashima. And what he discovered was that if you gave people very simple little calculations, for example, you know, what's 8 plus 7, and then you answer that, and then you get what's 3 plus 10, and you have to punch in the answer. What happens is that as you are calculating, this little machine gives you your accuracy rating, your percentage, obviously, your speed, and your progress over your previous time, so you can see how your brain is progressing.
Well, it took me as you were saying that, and your brain automatically sidetracks itself, doesn't it, on occasions like that?
Yes.
And while I was also listening to your reply, in 5 seconds I worked out 28.
I am impressed.
How am I doing?
This confirms that your brain is recovering a lot more rapidly than you thought
it was. I was terrible at numbers, but when it comes to adding things up and doing, I used to have to time scripts for news bulletins to make them perfectly 3 minutes, and they always used to hand them to me, and I am the least numerically literate person you would know.
Well, if you say that, but I would challenge you and say that you are probably very literate. And, I mean, check yourself on the Brain Trainer and just see, because your brain will, that will also help in terms of your concussion as well, that the Brain Trainer will accelerate your speed, it will accelerate your sharpness, it will accelerate in 5 minutes a day. And what the findings of Kawashima revealed were that just a tiny amount of training the brain every day gets it stronger a lot more rapidly. So over a year, you can actually, you develop your IQ, you develop your memory, you develop your accuracy and speed of thinking.
And the biggest test, I guess, Tony, is not the ability to do it, because I presume, you know, our brains are pretty much, you know, some people are cleverer than others, but yeah, we're all capable of improvement, but it's the wanting to do it.
That is exactly, when you want to do it and you have a simple thing like a brain trainer, memory books, whatever, it will actually help you improve whatever your ability is. And anyone can do it.
So you're not, you're guaranteeing me here, Tony, that this is not just the sort of thing that you would buy like the Rubik's Cube. You'd do it once and then put it in a cupboard and forget about it and then take it to the charity shop.
No, this one has the kind of delightful addition that it gives you a daily progress. And so it becomes a positive attraction to you. You kind of want to see how you're doing today. It's like any television program where they say, and tomorrow, you know, and you want to find out. So it's only 5 minutes.
Now, as I say, in 15 seconds or less, because the clock is ticking down on us now, and my brain's just worked that one out.
Very good.
How much cleverer do you think that we will be in the future? Do you think that we will develop this to the stage where now we will become, say, 20 years from now, much more mentally agile? And
yes, I do. I think that that things like the Brain Trainer will become part of everybody's daily routine, like brushing your teeth, and that the overall IQ and creativity of the human race will increase. It's already beginning statistically to go in that way.
If we don't blow ourselves up first.
Well, hopefully if we become more intelligent, we won't.
Tony Buzan, check him out on the internet, a fascinating man, TonyBuzan. Here comes another fascinating man, and a great privilege and a total pleasure to talk to him. His name is Patrick Moore. He's now in his early 80s, and his life has been astronomy. He is one of the best-known faces on British television for a late-night programme that he's been doing for 50 years here called The Sky at Night. It introduced me to stargazing and asking questions about what exactly is out there when we look up at night. Patrick Patrick Moore's a wonderful man, and on the occasion of the 50th anniversary, I had a fairly long talk with him about his life, about his times, about what he believed then and what he believes now. Here he is.
It hasn't changed very much, oddly enough. The program is not the same shape and format as it was 50 years ago. Of course, the whole of science is different. Don't forget, we began before the space age started, and things like quasars, pulsars, black holes were unknown, so there's been so much to cover. And what I've tried to do over the years is to bring astronomy down to the level where everyone can understand it, and introduce them to astronomy. And I hope we succeeded. It would be a great pleasure now to go around and find well-known amateur astronomers and well-known professionals who began by watching the sky at night, or
I know the British astronomer Heather Cooper quite well have over the years, and I know that she cites you among her personal hall of fame.
A long, long time ago.
Now,
I feel quite honoured today because we've got our 50th anniversary party down here, and I think almost all the top astronomers in the country are coming. And I feel very honoured indeed.
I heard on the radio, I think in America last week, that they're very excited there that moisture or the elements of water have been found or are believed to be in many places in our solar system, which of course gives us the possibility of life. What do you think about that?
I think the key may be the planet Mars. After all, Mars is less unlike the Earth than any other planet. And also, if we find any trace of life there, it will show that life will appear where it can. Of course, no Martians over here, but if there's any trace of life at all, it will show that life will appear where conditions are favourable. And that will give a key that life is widespread over the universe.
And what do you think of those people, and I've interviewed over the years some of those people, who claim that there are structures on Mars, and there has been, or maybe is, a civilization?
Oh dear. They're great fun. You always get the cranks, you know. You will always get them.
For me, and I wonder if for you, the greatest question in all of this as we stand here on the Earth, whether we use a telescope or a radio telescope or just our eyes, is to stare out and wonder if what we're seeing really is infinity. Do you believe it is infinite?
You can't describe infinity in ordinary words. Something goes on forever? No, we can't do it. You cannot put it into plain English, and neither could Einstein. I know, because I asked him.
And what did he say? What were the words that he used?
This is, we cannot tell. That's what he actually said. So if Einstein can't do it, I certainly can't.
Isn't that wonderful that you spoke to Einstein? As you look back over the 50 years and you look at the way things are now, do you ever consider retiring from this?
I'll go when I do the first bad program that I think is my fault. See, I'll go on as long as people want me, as long as I feel that I'm doing it decently. But I see the first bad program I do will also be my last. So we'll wait and see.
And there is a man in America who I'm sure you know called Seth Shostak, who is behind an organization called SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. I mean, they're very enthusiastic that one of these days they are going to get a signal from somewhere that indicates we are not alone.
Well,
do you
why
believe?
Not? Also, look at it this way. There are 100,000 million stars in our galaxy, and we know of 1,000 million galaxies, and that's only part. Therefore, the total number of stars is immense, and many of these have planets. There must be vast numbers of worlds where life could exist. And I said just now about Mars. The point is, if life can appear, will it? If it occurs on Mars as well as here, that will answer the question.
And do you think it may be intelligent life?
On Mars, no. In the universe, I'm sure. After all, our Earth is one of so many planets. Why should we be any intelligent creatures? I'm sure we're not.
Ah, the incomparable Patrick Moore, astronomer extraordinaire, still doing his astronomy in his garden near Chichester in the UK, and still doing the wonderful TV program The Sky at Night after 50 years. That show introduced me to thinking about what might be out there when I look up at night, those little twinkling lights. What's going on up there, and how far does that blackness extend? Is it forever? And if it's forever, what is forever? And if even Einstein doesn't know the answer to that question, then I'm never going to get it. And as Patrick said, he's going to retire from that program the first time he does a bad show. Well, that is never going to happen as far as I'm concerned. Thank you very much for being part of this edition of The Unexplained. Please return to the show when we return. If you have any thoughts about the show, please email me via the website www.theunexplained.tv. That's www.theunexplained.tv. Any ideas, suggestions, feedback, whatever. It's you who've kept me going throughout all of these months with your emails saying, where are you? Please come back. We like the show. It's very kind of you, and I promise to do my best to get this show back where it belongs, and that's on the radio. That's where it should be. And as I said at the top of this, it isn't me who's saying that. It's you who's saying that. So thanks again. Thank you to Graham Mullins, my webmaster. You'll find a link to Graham and his terrific work on the website. So if you want any web design doing, any web hosting, Graham knows all about it. He is the best. And thank you again to Martin for the theme tune for this program. Martin, I have not forgotten you, and I'm very grateful to you. Thank you for being part of The Unexplained. We will be back soon. My name's Howard Hughes.